You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Matt.
Hello.
How's it going?
I'm good.
Good. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. You are Matthew Iglesias.
I am.
Well-known journalist, co-founder of Vox, former Enfant Terrible. Is that how you pronounce it?
I think so.
Is that what you...
Terrible.
Thank you. Well, you were one. You'd know.
Yeah, but now I'm a...
Now you're a bête noire.
I'm a dad. Middle-aged.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll have time to talk about that whole transition.
Yeah.
Because when you first appeared on Blogging Heads, you were an enfant terrible.
Yeah.
But times change. And so now you've written a book we're going to talk about.
Sure.
It's your third book.
Yeah.
And it is called 1 Billion Americans, A Case for Thinking Bigger.
It is.
And how are you feeling about America these days?
It's going great.
It's going so well, you want to see it on a larger scale?
I need more of this. I want bigger and more. I think many things about the United States. My friend and colleague and co-founder of Vox, Ezra Klein, he wrote a book last year. It came out, I think. It's called Why We're Polarized.
Right. He was on the show.
Oh, there you go.
Good book.
It's a really good book. It covers, ground that I think is familiar to people. I mean, people are aware that we have a lot of polarization in our politics. Ezra, I think, shows that there's some pretty profound roots of that kind of dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And it can make you very depressed, I think, if you read it and you actually take seriously the scholarship and stuff that he marshals. And if you, I think, really understand it, and take those lessons to heart, you start to see that a lot of the things that worry people about America, American politics and government, are probably not going to get better. Donald Trump will probably lose the election, in 2 weeks.
Don't jinx it.
I'm saying, and I hope that he will. And I believe that some good things will happen if Joe Biden becomes president. But in a fundamental sense, we know how hampered anything will be as long as politics is dominated by zero-sum conflict between the two political parties. You've wrote a great book about that yourself a long time ago.
Zero-sumness and non-zero-sumness.
About zero-sumness and non-zero-sumness, right? And so policymaking is not zero-sum, right? You can do things.
It can be, but
sure, but
ideally,
It is possible to do things that address topics that worry conservatives while also addressing topics that worry progressives. But electoral politics is zero sum. Like, only one person can win the presidential election. Only one person can win the Senate seat in Iowa. So in a really big think, I've done a million interviews about this book, kind of sense, I wanted to try to think of some things that get America back in the sense of thinking about us as Americans versus external challenges, and therefore make us want to transcend some of the zero-sumness of domestic political conflict and work together toward big national objectives that accomplish things that I think a lot of people who may disagree about abortion or gun regulation think are important to them, such as the relative strength of our country vis-a-vis rival nations, the viability of American families, and the sort of, American project in a 20th century sense.
You want to make America great again.
I do.
Now, this actually, I was going to ask you, so I don't think we've quite said, you think America should have 1 billion people instead of a piddling 300 million plus.
Triple the population, remain the world's number one economy in the aggregates forever. dominate the world.
Chant, we're number one.
It's a project for a new American century.
What a great idea.
I regret to inform
you that that label has already been taken. Although they're out of business.
I'm taking all the terrible right-wing slogans.
The good news is most of the people associated with it no longer want to remind people that they were associated with it. So, but that's not totally unrelated actually to your book in the following sense. Here's the question I was going to ask you. Can you guess the part of your book that most rubbed me the wrong way?
I think that the themes of international conflict and rivalry are not very Bob Wright.
Well, I mean,
you want us to all get along.
I would like us to all get, and that's the funny thing. I think you would too, but
I would in principle.
Well, in fact, you argue that a bigger, more prosperous, more dominant America can actually do a better job of cooperating on the international stage. But before we get to that, yes. I would just like to read a little of the language that rubbed me the wrong way, if it's okay.
There we go. Yes.
But now we face, this is Matt talking, but now we face a very real challenge that we have to meet. Rapid ongoing economic growth in India and especially China is leading to the relative decline of the United States of America as a great power. And I'm adding the italics here. And it threatens our position as the world's number one state in the not too distant future. We can and should stay number one forever.
Absolutely.
Now, Matt, forever is a long time. Like, couldn't we say over three millennia of hegemony or something?
Okay, that is fair enough. Yeah, I think, sometimes you write things and, a million years, 2 million, I don't know. I should say, I guess, for the indefinite future. See what happens. I mean, I would not be opposed, right? I mean, this to be fanciful but semi-serious about it, right? I mean, if at some point in the future we have a Immanuel Kant perpetual peace global confederation,
I'm working on it.
That does not seem like I don't quite see the, like, how do we get from here to there to it, but I'm not opposed to that as a concept. In the past, I've been more optimistic about it. I really like Star Trek.
Are you changing the subject, Matt?
No, I'm not. I really identify with the kind of, mid-century American liberalism that you see in those shows, in which in the future you have a global government or interplanetary even, but it's also really just America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could work with that. I will at a later date try to persuade you that we can get from here to there. But meanwhile, just to make sure people understand what we're saying, the organizing principle of the book is we have to be bigger and better than any other country. And in the name of that, do a number of things that you've been a fan of for some time on the mainly domestic policy front.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, this is, not a book. I think. A conventional Washington way to think about this would be to say, all right, we're worried about China. We're going to need like 14 aircraft carriers or maybe 17 or something like that. Or maybe we need to give Taiwan better missiles. But it seems to me that really, international relations is dominated on some level by the fundamentals of the situation. And that the biggest things the United States needs to do to be, have global influence are domestic. And, I talk in the book, you sometimes hear gestures in this direction. Like, I think Barack Obama said, like, we need to do his infrastructure plan to, like, win the 21st century or something, which is fine. But, the main ideas of the book are that we should do more to support families and young children, make it easier for people to have somewhat larger families, increase the population growth rate, and also open up to more immigration. And then various things happen downstream of more rapid population growth on the housing front, on the transportation front. This ties together a lot of sort of domestic policy topics that I have been interested in for a while and that I had sort of, you know, been working on as separate issues, but come to see as related conceptually, both in practical levels, but also in terms of at least my strong belief that in the economic domain, we see increasing returns to scale and that people's thinking about these topics is dominated by a kind of false sense of scarcity and resource competition, which is not really how modern human interactions should go.
Okay. So let's put a pin in my own pet peeve about the kind of nationalist spirit of it. Not that nationalism is a bad thing. And maybe get back to that. And for now, like, take these two subjects in turn, kind of immigration is one source of growth and like having babies is another source of growth.
Yeah.
So on the immigration front, well, first of all, why don't you flesh out your position a little? You would have what kind of immigration, how much would you, as you may know, the immigration has been a subject of some political strife domestically in America. This may not have escaped your attention.
I'm actually very disappointed. You know, your collaborator, Mickey Kouse, and I, we disagree a lot about immigration, but we both wish Donald Trump would talk about it more in the 2020 campaign. Mickey, because he thinks Trump is correct about immigration, and me, because I would like to sell books. And I was expecting to be, more relevant to this election campaign. But you know, immigration, I think, is very underrated. What I have seen from looking at academic research on the impact of immigration is basically that it's really good. It has incredibly large benefits for the immigrants themselves and smaller but real benefits to the arriving countries. But in most of the Western world, well, I shouldn't just say Western, it's in some ways worse in developed Asia, there's a tendency to treat immigration as like a gift from the host country to the immigrants, that like it's good for them, but it's costly to us. Mm-hmm. So we need to, you know, we maybe don't want to be 100% cold hearted about it, but we really got to watch our backs. So I really don't think that that's correct. I also do operate in the real world of politics though. And so I really want us to get more immigrants, if we can, significantly more if possible. But I would also urge progressive minded people to be a little bit more politically open-minded about what kind of proposals we say yes to and which we say no to. There's a lot of people on the right toy with the idea that we should shift to a more skill-based immigration framework, which they then typically pair with saying, well, and then we should cut down on immigration a lot. I don't think we should cut down on immigration, but if conservatives would really be less hostile to immigrants, if we selected ones with STEM degrees or whatever else, like, I think, you know, people should go for that. And there is some evidence for it. I used to be a huge skeptic of this idea. I thought it was just like 100% a fake out. But political scientists who've looked at Europe do show that when arriving populations have a higher skill profile, the sort of local native born people have a more positive reaction to them, which was interesting because to me, I always kind of thought of Americans as enjoying the kind of American dream narrative of people arriving like penniless from abroad, and then they work hard and then their kids get, you know, learn English mm-hmm. and do stable jobs. Whereas the idea of like, just like Indian born doctors parachuting into town and immediately being high status people seemed to me actually politically dicier. But I don't know. Republicans say it's good. I've seen some pretty good research that says people like it. The economic benefits of skilled immigrants are in fact larger. So, you know, I think we should be open to that idea. So but we should get more, not less.
You're saying Well, you mean we should, it's not so much that we should cut down on the amount, the kind of unskilled labor immigration as increase the skilled immigration? I mean, get specific. Like, what would you do on the southern border?
What would I do on the southern border?
Or with respect to the kinds of immigrants who cross the southern border?
Sure, sure. I would try to be generous to asylum seekers. I would want to try to create an application process rather than the current thing of like you turn yourself in to CBP and then you kind of hope for good luck at the trial. But I mean, I'm trying to say a difference between like if I was just in charge, I would be more generous to asylum seekers. I would increase the refugee quota and I would let in way, way, way more skilled immigrants. But I don't think that it makes a lot of sense to be dogmatic about it, politically speaking. Like, I want to find whichever levers we can pull, and I want to convince people that, for example, refugees are more beneficial to the country than a lot of people think. But, like, if they're not persuaded about that, I don't want to see our politics completely deadlocked around fighting about refugees, you know? So right now, the way Congress functions, they operate within a visa cap, right? And anytime somebody proposes like, well, we should make it easier for computer programmers to move here, they'll say, and then the way we do that is by one for one getting rid of diversity lottery visas. And then, you know, liberals don't want to do that, so we get nowhere. And somebody should counter propose like, look, if you want to get more computer programmers in here, like maybe we could just do that. Like if they're good, if we agree that they're beneficial, like, you know, let's just come put them in. So yeah, that's a tedious story. The specific asylum seekers at the southern border question, I do think is a little bit tricky because it blends an immigration policy question with a lot of questions about America's relationship with these Central American states, that I don't honestly know that much about.
Okay, but leaving aside the fact that right now a big issue is asylum seeking, just in terms of your quantity of unskilled workers or low-skilled workers from Latin America,
sure.
you would keep that pretty low. In other words, I was going to ask, like, well, if your goal is to bring America together, advocating a lot of immigration seems like a funny way to do it, given that we know that's going to so antagonize a non-trivial number of Americans that they support somebody like Donald Trump for president. But it sounds like actually the number of low-skilled laborers you'd want to see cross the border, they might not find that threatening. I don't know.
I mean, I think the case in particular for Latin American migrants is fairly weak in the scheme of things. Those are neither the sort of biggest hard luck cases in the world, you know, from a humanitarian viewpoint, nor are they the most economically beneficial to the United States.
Well, they're more hard luck than all the computer programmers you want to let in.
Yes. But I mean, I'm saying in terms of like refugee admittances, I think it's like really horrifying how low Trump has cut them down to. Right. So, I mean, it's immigrants from Mexico in particular are in a little bit of a like ethical dead zone at this point where like it's a middle income country. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of worse off people in the world who we should try to help. The main thing that I write about in some detail is about, agricultural guest workers, which wound up being not controversial. Donald Trump, for whatever reason, has actually not cut down on agricultural workers and has taken some steps during the pandemic to actually make it easier for people to get visas to do that, which I hate to agree with Trump about anything he does on immigration. But that's actually correct. Like a big way U.S. immigration policy went awry in the 90s, I think, is that we actually made it harder for people to do, you know, rotational work in the fruit picking and vegetable picking sectors. So people wound up staying without papers. But the simplest solution to that kind of problem is to actually create a legal pathway to do it. I don't want to say that Trump has done that exactly, but he has moved in that direction. And I think it's good.
And on the high skilled immigrants, you don't worry. I mean, this is a typical question from me, I guess. You don't worry about the brain drain issue as it afflicts the countries they come from?
I don't think so. You know, Michael Clemens works on this a lot and, you know, seems to indicate that there's not a big brain drain problem from sending countries. You don't really see foreign governments like that worried about this kind of thing in a practical sense. I mean, it would be kind of horrifying, I think, if, you know, India was like trying to stop people from going abroad. But, you know, so two things happen, right? When you create legal channels for people with specified skills to go migrate to other places, one is that it increases domestic investment in the human capital, right? Because like if you're living in Nigeria, getting a nursing degree is like, it's better than not having one, but the economic rewards to that are pretty meager. Whereas they're quite large if you're able to go be a nurse in the UK, and they would be even larger if you could go be a nurse in the United States. So you sort of create some of the educational infrastructure around that. Some people wind up staying. But the other thing is that throughout modern history, lots of people who emigrate wind up coming back home, you know, for all kinds of reasons. I mean, and we know this domestically, right? It's very normal for a person, you know, to grow up in the Midwest, go to college, move to a coastal city, do whatever. And then at a certain point, it's like you're married, you have kids, you wind up moving to where one or the other, you know, either the husband or the wife live, be closer to grandparents, you're more settled. And so, you know, immigrants do that kind of thing all the time and cycle back home. Your money goes further at home. So I don't see brain drain as a big problem in practice. I guess it could, I mean, it could happen in theory, right? Like, I don't want to be a total dogmatist about this. If you started hearing from, I don't know what, like the president of Brazil, that like the country's being crippled by, you know, too many architects moving to Chicago or something, we might need to worry about it, but I just don't really see it.
Okay. And then, just maybe, kind of finally on immigration, how do you read the literature? You talk about this a little in the book. I mean, to what extent, leaving aside the fact that maybe amping up low-skilled immigration just isn't a great idea politically right now, to what extent do you think the fears kind of in middle America that were of immigration that we're told about and that supposedly helped propel Trump into office are well-founded? In other words, to what extent does the low-skill competition lower wages? How enduringly do people who come from, you know, low-skill immigrants have that effect, if at all? And then there's, of course, the ancillary concerns about, you know, crime and whatever,
yeah,
I guess.
I mean, I don't think there is good evidence that working-class immigrants lower working-class wages for Americans. I think we see that the people who want to make that case have to really reach. I mean, you can take, you know, George Borjas, for example, some people question his research, but don't question it, right? He says that a completely uncontrolled influx of Cubans to the Miami area in 1980 led to a decline in wages for native-born, non-Cuban Hispanic men who didn't graduate from high school. Right. So, okay. I mean, like, so what? Right? Like, I mean, not to say so what. If you are a native-born, non-Cuban Hispanic man without a college degree, you know, that's bad for you. But that's a small fraction of the population, right? And there are not a lot of other areas of policymaking in which we give strict priority to male high school dropouts. Non-Cuban Hispanic ones in particular. So it's very questionable to me. I think a useful thing.
Before we get to your useful thing, can I drill down on that? You talk about the Borjas study in the book and you say it turns out that in terms of, you know, his empirical basis for saying this about that very carefully defined subgroup you mentioned, there were only 17 of those in his study. who are these native born, blah, blah, blah. I have a question. Do you know, like, was he fully forthcoming about that from the get-go, or did he kind of not exactly put that in boldface in the study?
It was not, you know, well highlighted, I think, in the original one. So they go back and forth, and I just, like, you know, some people have made very strong charges against him, which I don't really want to get into, because it, you know, academics like to nitpick, but I actually think that, like, what policymakers need to know is that this is a disagreement about a really narrow kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So there was a more recent study that maybe it's not technically about immigration, because it's about people from Puerto Rico, but it's the same basic issue, and people may find it more persuasive because it's more current, which is a ton of people moved from Puerto Rico to Orlando after Hurricane Maria. And what they find is that pay did go down in the construction sector, because you had there's only so many construction projects that sort of go on at any given time. And you had more people who could do that work. So pay went down. But at the same time, pay went up in the restaurant and retail sectors, because you had more customers for the businesses. So people wanted to stay open longer hours or hire extra people for shifts. So pay went up, and on balance, it went, you know, it canceled out, right? The sort of short-term balance for low-wage workers. And then for skilled people, it just went up. So, you know, if you think about the long-term potential of that, right, you actually saw a decline in pay in the sector that produces capital goods and a rise in pay in the sector that doesn't. So if you project that forward 5-10 years, you're going to have a much wealthier Orlando.
Yeah.
When it comes out, that's what the CBO models about this say. The thing about Trump, which I think has been helpful to everybody, is that he, I think, really made clear that objections to immigration are not about fussy labor market economics issues. You know, like, he's talked extensively about why it is people should worry about liberals' ideas on immigration. And he's, like, really not in there with the census microdata on wages and stuff like that. Like,
uncharacteristically, he did not in this particular case take time to delve into this.
No, but, you know, so, like, his discussions about trade with China, I think, are crazy and wildly inaccurate. But the subject of his discussions is, like, jobs in the economy. Mm-hmm. So, like, he knows how to say foreigners are responsible for your job losses, if that's what he wants to say. And that's not what he says about immigration, right? He says that immigrants are rapists and murderers, that terrorists are sneaking in. And he says that people like Ilhan Omar don't love America enough. Right, that we are letting sort of a fifth column into our country to breed, and he says, well, we should have more people from Norway, right? So, in that case, right, like, I think that's all very irresponsible of him to say, but it's, like, it's not false that when you let more immigrants come from non-white countries, that you have demographic change in the United States and elements of life change, and the people who are annoyed by, you know, like, I don't want to press one for English, or I don't see why there should be Spanish signs in my local Target. They are not, like, quote unquote, wrong, right? Like, that impact does exist. And, you know, the question is like, do we want to be a poorer and lesser country because we are terrified of, seeing some Somali people on the street? And, like, I don't want to be that. I think that's bad. Yeah,
I hadn't thought of that when he does put forth his explanation for wage stagnation and job loss in middle America, it's, and blame foreigners for it, it's typically in the realm of trade and not in the realm of immigration. I hadn't really thought about that, but it's definitely the case, I guess. It's kind of odd too, because I've got to think that a lot of middle Americans, I mean, however, whatever your model is of how the opposition to immigration plays out in their brains, and to what extent we can call it racism, and to what extent we can call it that, something else, I'm sure that some of them look at the local meatpacking plant and see that it's full of immigrants and say, that's one of the reasons my son can't get a job, right? It's almost kind of odd that Trump doesn't plan that explicitly.
Well, I mean, I do think that it indicates that, you know, people, the whole, like, these are jobs Americans don't want kind of thing, mm-hmm. you know, like, that can get overdone. But they are not jobs that people aspire to have their children go do, like, which is why that's not the political message, right? Like, nobody goes around and is like, if not for these immigrants,
your
kids could be picking strawberries in the Central Valley. That's right. Not an appealing vision right. of the future to anybody. So, you know, and I mean, that's actually the area where it's clearly true, right? If there were literally no foreign-born people in the United States, we would have way fewer fruits and vegetables. But the people who picked them would have to get paid more because to persuade a native-born American to relocate themselves to where the lettuce farms are, like, you'd have to pay a decent amount of money. And, like, we would have way less lettuce as a result, because also, like, people aren't going to go to the store and, like, pay through the nose for this stuff. And it would be bad for the economy. But strictly speaking, like, somebody would have the opportunity to go be a fruit and vegetable picker in the hot sun in Arizona and California. But nobody says that, because that's not what anybody wants, right? Whereas the idea that you could get, like, a stable middle-class job with good benefits by working in the car factory. Like, people like that. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah,
right?
No,
so, now, whether it's true that, like, these various tariffs will create that future, you know, is a good subject to argue about. Yeah. But that's actually something people would like to do. You know, people are not sitting around in West Virginia worried about union jobs in the coal mines and then saying, well, what I'd really like to do is move to Los Angeles and go be somebody's nanny. For starters, like, there's nothing stopping them from doing that, right? But if you're like, okay, this is my solution to, like, people would think that was, like, the most deranged, out of touch neoliberal take you could possibly imagine.
It's the kind of, like, thing Matt Iglesias might say, actually.
Well, exactly, right. So I actually think, you know, there's a reason for that, right? I mean, so that's why the immigration rhetoric is all about, you know, it's about physical threat, and then it's about cultural change. And, you know, we can characterize that in different ways. I used to just say it was racism. I've now moved away from that language because I'm trying to be a more respectful person. But either way, it's not a question grounded in empirical labor market economics.
Okay. Now, do you remember the thing you were going to say and whether you got around to saying it when I interrupted you with that methodological question about Boros?
Oh, it was just that about Trump.
Okay. So you want more immigration and in part for political reasons, you're willing for it to be concentrated in the high skill area. Let's talk about big families and, the challenges. I guess part of the premise is that people would like to have more families and bigger families if it weren't so hard to do for various reasons. And a certain amount of the book is about making it easier to have big families, right?
Yeah, I got interested in this. I sort of backed into this. I was a proponent for quite a while of child allowance policy, which is a lot of Western governments do this. One came in Canada recently, but it's like the government just gives you money for having kids at home because kids are expensive. And this is talked about in the circles I run in as an anti-poverty policy. And it's very effective anti-poverty policy. Senate Democrats wrote a bill to do this, and it would, like, cut child poverty in half. Tony Blair did something similar in the UK. It's a very sort of hot topic among, like, center-left policy wonk kind of people. And I came across a cranky right-wing guy named Lyman Stone, and he was writing about this for the Institute for Family Studies, which is a you know, conservative. Family studies means in a right wing kind of way, studying families. And he was saying this would lead people to have about 0.25 more children on average, which he said was a good thing. And I was interested in the fact that, like, none of the progressive people who work on this topic seem to have any, like, interest in this at all. Like, it wasn't something they talked about or published any PDFs about or anything like that. But so it turns out that, you know, in the 70s, the number of kids people said they wanted went down. And we don't have general social survey questions from back in the 50s, but I think it's reasonable to infer that we were seeing a steady decline from the sort of peak baby boom down to about 1980 or so. But starting in 1980, people's fertility ideals don't really change. It trades in a very narrow 2.4 to 2.7 band. But actual fertility keeps going down a little bit each year, but it very, very steadily. And over the past couple of years, it dropped below the sort of arbitrary 2.1 children per woman threshold that demographers consider replacement rate. So we started getting more media attention to this. And the New York Times did some polls and they like asked people, you know, like people who say they would in theory like to have more children, why don't you? And the answers they give are overwhelmingly financial in nature. People say either that they can't afford childcare. They say they don't have enough money in a generic sense. They say that they got too old trying to achieve financial stability. And so like a lot of different ways of saying the same thing.
And what's the correlation with income level here? I mean, is this a concern at kind of all income levels or what?
Yeah, it's just a sort of flat thing, right? So you could say, well, okay, obviously objectively, this can't quite be true, right? Because if people, if poor people can have children, then how can it be that people with low six-figure incomes think they can't afford an extra child? There's a subjectivity to it, right? I mean, people are saying the hit to their lifestyle would be large, which so you could dismiss that as like just nonsense. Like I'm not necessarily a huge believer in taking people at their word when they say why they do things. But what is definitely true is that the cost of childcare has gone up dramatically faster than the overall cost price of inflation. And this is something I've been interested in for a long time is that, you know, if you ask like normal people, they are always saying, and you see this in all kinds of polls and all kinds of stories and just conversations I've had, people are always talking about how it's like harder than ever to make ends meet, blah, 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 blah. And the economic, you know, kind of nerds, will be like, no, like that's not true. Like, per capita incomes are going up. So, you know, if you decompose it, right, some things get cheaper over time and some things get more expensive. So like TVs are way cheaper, right? Like I have a TV upstairs in my house that I got for like $400 and like it's giant. It looks amazing.
Is it 4K?
It's 4K.
Can you tell me something that's not related to your book? When are they going to start broadcasting sports in 4K? They're not doing it yet, right?
Yes, I think there's a bandwidth limitation on the broadcasting set.
When is that going to go away?
I don't know.
Well,
you got to interview somebody
else. There's your next book.
But so I work in my basement now because of the pandemic, and here I have my ancient 2005 vintage HDTV, and like it sucks and it cost way more, right? So it's like TVs get cheaper, cell phone data plans have gotten cheaper, a lot of stuff has gotten cheaper, but then it's offset by other things have gotten much more expensive, and childcare and college tuition really lead the list of things that have gotten more expensive. So what's happened is not that like living standards have fallen, but that a specific kind of thing that is important to a lot of people, which is having children, raising them, and doing it with a certain middle class je ne sais quoi to your lifestyle, has in fact gotten a lot more expensive. And that's corresponded with people having fewer children, but saying they want as many children as they ever did. And a lot of, people feeling upset about the trajectory of the economy. But we can address this stuff. Like, it is not beyond our capacity to give people extra money to help out with the financial burdens of child rearing. This is actually a very wealthy society that we live in. We all have giant houses and awesome cars and super rich people with billions of dollars. Like, we can do it.
And in general, you would not make the assistance particularly sensitive to income level, both for the reason you gave, that this is a concern at you know, all across the income spectrum, and because as a political matter, it's hard to garner support for things that don't help most Americans, including reasonably affluent ones.
Yeah, I mean, but to me, those things sort of go together, right? So, I mean, I was in college. I took class with the Scotchpole, great political scientist. You know, she really makes the pitch for universality as a political measure. But you sort of need to think, like, well, why is that, right? Like, why does universality bite? And I thought about that in this child allowance framing, right? That it's like it actually means different things to society if you're saying this is a subsidy that goes to low-income families with children because we're trying to move people above the poverty line, or if we're saying this is a subsidy that goes to all people with children because we're saying that having children is a socially validated, like, thing that we care about, right? Now, you can tweak the tax, you know, you can turn them to be distributionally equivalent, and, you know, you can do anything sort of in the plumbing of a tax and transfer program, but you are making a different statement about, like, what is the purpose of this program. And I think that a program to make it affordable to have and raise children is like an idea with broad appeal and good sense and speaks to things that conservative people think are important, as well as things that progressive people think are important. And it's great that it would dramatically reduce the child poverty rate in the United States. Like, that is, like, another reason to think that it's a good idea to do this. Just like Social Security is, like, something everybody loves, retirement is good, it's cut elder poverty enormously. But it's also just like, it's not just like middle class people get the money and they like it, but it's like we have a social consensus that, you know, people in their 70s, like, shouldn't need to be working for a living.
Right. So tick off a few of the ways you would make it easier to have kids.
Yeah. So child allowance is a big one. The other thing is, I think we need to look at how we do school provision in the United States. We, you know, right now, like, school ends at 3:30. It just doesn't function in the summer. There's all kinds of weird days off that most people don't have as their holidays. There's a few different ways we could address that kind of thing. But I think the current system of not addressing it at all is, like, clearly wrong. So there's some people make the case for year-round school. I used to be a super enthusiast for year-round schooling. Then in DC, they did an experiment with it, and they felt it did not actually produce significant academic gains for kids. So it would be cheaper to just sort of run, like, city-run summer camps or give people vouchers than to, like, try to make teachers work year-round. So, you know, maybe we should do that instead. After school,
the main goal being to permit their parents to work year-round.
Well, or to spare parents from paying out, you know, because right now it's like, it's not like parents don't work in the summertime, right? It's an additional cost, right? And then we'll say, well, it's fine. Like, these middle-class families can afford it. But, you know, can they really? And it's also a social unity thing, right? Like, it's, I think, so, like, my son goes to a very diverse public school that's in our neighborhood, which is good. And, you know, we want to support it and blah, blah, blah. But then over the summer, you see a real divergence in experiences, right? Where the rich kids are in, like, fancy camp and the low-income kids are, like, you know, staying with somebody's sister or, you know, all kinds of different scrapped together things. For basic, like, social cohesion reasons, I think it would be good to have formal summer programming. I'm not, like, a dogmatic about what exactly that should look like. So those are the main ones. Then I also think we need to look at some of the regulatory stuff on the childcare side. There has been a real trend toward increasing the stringency of how we regulate childcare centers, sometimes for good reasons, but often in a slightly thoughtless way. There was also this amazing paper came out, sadly, after I was done with the book, but it was looking at car seat rules. So car seats are great. Like, they help save kids' lives. But there has been a trend to raising the age at which you have to keep kids in car seats. So one consequence of this is that it's made it much, much harder to have a third child, because a standard car will not fit three car seats in the back. Right. And so I should have this guy's name. But anyway, he went and looked at it, and there's pretty plausible evidence that like thousands of third children per year are not being born as a result of the upward extension of the car seat age limit. And the number of lives plausibly saved by this is pretty trivial. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that like we have not subjected enough real scrutiny to, right? I mean, not to get too metaphysical about it, but like the cost of benefit analysis on these regulations typically does not include like the non-existence of potential human beings. And you would probably get into trouble with pro-choice people if you were to even suggest that. But I think still, regardless of that, like in the real world, like that's a significant cost that needs to be weighed against these things. So, you know, I'm for car seats, like to a point, but like nobody thinks like, well, we should have to have special car safety seats, you know, until you're 15. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we should draw the line a little more laxly around some safety stuff.
So then what about higher education? A big cost.
Ooh, higher education. It's like higher education is such a quagmire. And really needs to be its own book. So I'm kind of taken with Kevin Carey's a sort of education policy expert, higher education guy. So he says that instead of trying to like pump more subsidy into the existing set of institutions, we should try to charter some new institutions that provide a zero tuition model, and some other desirable features, credit transferability, things like that, and try to promote like a different way of thinking about like what public universities are for and how they should work. Shoveling more money at it is not the worst idea.
So you're not a Bernie Sanders guy on this. Free college for all.
I'm not against it exactly, but if I got to tell Bernie Sanders what dramatic expansion of the welfare state we should argue for, it would be about little kids, not about college students. I just think the case is much more compelling for, you know, free daycare, for universal preschool, things like that, than for zero tuition.
Even on egalitarian grounds as opposed to population growth grounds, which is his concern with college, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I just think the distributional consequences of free college are not great. You know?
Yeah, well, and of course,
it's because we have pretty generous financial. I mean, if you want to look at what's inequitable about higher education in the United States, right, which is a lot, it's that the most of the money goes to the prestigious institutions whose admission standards keep out most of the kids from lower income families, right? And so that's like famously true in the sort of private side of the system, that like people have shoveled billions of dollars at Harvard, but it's true for public universities too, right? So, you know, like the state of Texas provides a lot more support to UT Austin students who have like objectively lower levels of need than like kids in a community college in Houston. You know, so my son is five, and I try not to do the woke toddler thing. But when he found out that college isn't like regular school, you don't just go to the one that's closest to your house, his like intuition was just like, oh, so the kids who need more help can go to the better colleges. And I was like, no, it's the opposite of that.
he is not ready to enter the real world.
So anyway, I mean, this is not a book about higher education. But were I to do, you know, try to really look at higher education, I just think like the inequitability of the system is built in so much deeper than mm-hmm. like the fact that you have to pay tuition to go. Mm-hmm. And actually the one thing that we do equitably is that most schools offer actually very generous financial aid if you are from a genuinely needy family. Mm-hmm. The problem is they probably won't let you in at all.
Now, there's a line in your book where you encourage the establishment of some like super high powered colleges in Appalachia. And the rationale, I think, is maybe a little different from what we've been dwelling on. But do you want to take time to complain about what this reviewer in the New Republic said about that or anything else he said?
I think he said, like UNC is in Appalachia.
Yeah, he was defining Appalachia in broad geographic terms rather than cultural and socioeconomic terms. Yeah, as so many people take it.
No, yes. So I don't want to complain about that. So one of, you know, a big part of the book is just like, okay, if we tripled the population, like where would the people be? Right? Like what would we be doing? So one thing that I think we should try to be doing is, you know, invest in parts of the country that are losing people right now. So, you know, I talk about the sort of large Midwestern cities that have big infrastructure, things like that. But then I also suggest when we're talking about higher education and chartering new institutions that it would probably be a good idea to put them in some of the poorest parts of the country, mm-hmm. like Appalachia, like the Mississippi Delta, which is different. I mean, these are actually because of Trump, these things get sort of like mixed together and people will talk about Michigan as if it's like the same as West Virginia. Mm-hmm. But they're actually totally different trajectories, right? Like in the Midwest, we had really big cities that like used to be like the thriving high-tech hubs of industrial America. And they've lost people. They've lost their industrial clusters. But like they have great cultural institutions. There's like a ton of stuff in Detroit and Cleveland. There just isn't a ton of high, like well-paid jobs, which is different from Appalachia, which has always been the poorest part of the United States, doesn't have any substantial cities in them and doesn't have like big institutions and would just benefit in a sort of straightforward way from even just like some military largesse, which, you know, bypass that region. You know, any little thing helps. Whereas I think it's just a different set of issues in the Midwest.
So climate change enters your book in a few different ways. There's one thing I don't think this is in the book, but it's I have heard that some millennials and whatever the generation after millennials is called, is that Z?
Yeah, they're Zoomers.
Okay, Zoomers. Well, we're all Zoomers now, but okay. That some of them are actually not don't want to have kids because of climate change, because the future is going to be so horrible. Now, have you heard that?
People say that. I don't see any real evidence for it.
Okay.
It is definitely a thing that people. So I, in the book, I disagree with this sort of climate change doomsayers. And I always struggle to characterize my view of climate change because I think that part of how politics is weird, right, is that like there's a whole intellectual space that's like very vibrant and people write takes and there's all kinds of dialogue and it has nothing to do with what the government actually does. So relative to people who talk a lot about politics on the internet, I would say I am a kind of like, maybe chill out a little about climate change. Mm-hmm. But like relative to the Congress of the United States of America, yeah. I'm like, you guys got to do a lot more about climate change, you know? Yeah. So like, I don't want to say I have like a quote unquote contrarian view of climate change. Like my view is that we should be doing much, much more to price carbon dioxide emissions, to prioritize climate change in our international agreements, to invest in clean energy, to invest in infrastructures, all that good stuff. What I don't think is that 4 degrees of climate change is an apocalyptic event before which all else needs to be sacrificed. It would be really bad, but a lot of really bad things have happened in human history. I expect you will be sympathetic to this view, but it's like when you're talking about catastrophes, it's actually really important to think rigorously about them, right? Like if we sent the Air Force over to India to drop bombs on coal plants, that would greatly reduce the odds of 4 degrees of climate change globally, but it would so sharply increase the odds of like a cataclysmic nuclear war, right? And so everybody knows it would be a bad idea to do that. Like I don't, even the most alarmist environmental people don't say we should do that, but like they should think about why they don't say we should do that, right? That like in the ranking of catastrophes, there are much worse ones out there than rising sea levels. So what was I saying about this? In the book, I don't think that we should allow concern about climate change to cause us to become antinatalists who don't think that future generations should exist. And I certainly don't think we should say it's bad when people from poor countries move to the United States and achieve a higher living standard because their CO2 emissions go up.
Mm-hmm. Climate change enters your argument in a couple of ways. You enlist it in a way in support of your immigration argument by saying that, you know, part of adapting to climate change is people in hot, barren places or various places that may be affected adversely by climate change moving to places like America, or at least to certain parts of America that will be doing perfectly fine even when the temperature has risen. So that's a pro for your argument. You acknowledge though that when relatively low income people move to America, they tend to move toward a lifestyle that's going to consume, you know, consume more carbon and stuff.
No, I mean the emissions go up. I think the thing though that is the most important to talk about with you though is the question of international cooperation on climate change.
That was going to be my next question.
This is what environmentalist-minded people don't talk about a lot. I mean, they will like say we should have international cooperation on climate change. It's a very difficult problem, you know. Like, it's not. There's a lot of things that we could do better if everyone like just like told the fossil fuel lobbyists to shut up. But the global cooperation part is genuinely challenging, right? And people need to think of a plausible story about how that cooperation is going to work. And the closest thing I think you get to that, right, is Nordhaus, who, you know, won the Nobel Prize. He says, look, like a big country, right, like the European Union could say, okay, we're going to have a carbon price domestically, and we are going to impose an external like carbon tariff. And then we're going to encourage you, other countries, to get into our carbon pricing club. And so if the US and EU cooperate together, that becomes like a really powerful club. And then they can really deploy coercive pressure on other countries to sort of get in on the action. And it's plausible insofar as like you can imagine an environmentally minded political party winning office in the United States and then going to Europe, where America is going to be more ecologically minded, would be a kind of welcome message. And, you know, maybe you sign Canada on, things like that. But thinking about how this vision is going to go over in the developing world, and especially in China, which is the number one source of emissions, and India, which is where they're growing fastest, I think there's a lot of question marks, right, around how any of this is supposed to work. I think that having the US and China be sort of peer competitors while we're also trying to say to them, like, oh, we promise, like we're just like looking out for the coral reefs. I think that's going to be tough. I think that's a tougher sell fundamentally than a vision in which we, through our own domestic actions, are just objectively on the top of the pile. We're not like trying to keep anybody down. Just like we don't have like a global rivalry with the Bahamas. Like we're just bigger. And right. It is what it is. And so the Bahamas, they don't think, they're like, oh, what's America trying to do? Like, how are they trying to get over on us? And I think that like taking global leadership off the table as a contested issue arguably makes it easier to solve this difficult cooperative problem.
So you're saying China right now suspects that when we talk global warming, we're actually just trying to keep them poor by keeping them from doing the very things we did 100 years ago to, or 50 years ago, whatever, in the course of industrializing and kind of spewing stuff out with reckless abandon, which was our approach. And you think in that model, we feel threatened by their growth, and so we want to keep them poor. And you think if we were so clearly superior to them in aggregate economic power, they would no longer suspect that we feel threatened enough to want to keep them down and would accept in good faith that we just want them to reduce their emissions. Now, that's a pretty complicated argument.
I think it gets easier, right? I mean, I think a big question in every U.S.-China bilateral dialogue at this point is like, what is America trying to do, right? Because it's a challenging moment, right? It's always a challenging moment when you have like powers rising and falling in kind of relative terms. And we are not saying in our overt messaging or our quiet messaging that we look at this as similar to the transition between the British Empire and the United States. And we welcome the growth of China and look forward to them and their value system predominating across the world. And we just hope we can maintain a special relationship with them. And here's, you know, a nice desk of George Washington.
That's definitely not what we're saying. No, right. and it's not what you're recommending.
I mean, it's not what I'm recommending, but I mean, just to be clear, like, it's not what we are saying, and it's not what anybody is saying.
That we welcome our new Chinese overlords. I haven't heard anybody running for office say that.
So I think this very naturally poses in Chinese eyes the question of, like, what is the deal with anything the United States does? Because if we're not prepared to give way to Chinese supremacy, then it would seem that we are trying to sabotage Chinese economic growth. Right? I think that is a natural interpretation, the far and away the most natural interpretation of everything Donald Trump does on trade, of everything Democrats say about trade and jobs, and of a lot of the global climate agenda. And I think that it would behoove us to come up with a different answer to the question of what is it we're trying to do here exactly. So my answer is we're going to grow our population. We welcome Chinese economic growth totally sincerely, because it's not going to plow us under. It is just good. Like, you know, they've got this Sinovac vaccine that they're working on. Which hopefully, I mean, I don't know anything about vaccines, but like hopefully will pan out. Like in principle, having other countries be less poor is good for us, because they do things and we all share ideas and it's lovely. And you know, the other way we could go is try to say, okay, is there a way that we are going to just kind of cede ground? And I just don't. I don't know. I feel like you're the person to make the case for that. Cause like, I don't hear anybody doing it explicitly.
Well, I would certainly say our stance should not be one of feeling threatened by Chinese economic growth. I'm just not sure that if we embarked on the path you recommend, and stayed well ahead of China and were, you know, unequivocally the dominant nation in the world, that would necessarily defuse the situation in the ways you suggest. I mean, for starters, it's like some of China's assumption that we wish them ill has to do with things we say about Taiwan, about Hong Kong, about their aspirations in the, you know, in various real and fake islands in their vicinity, Tibet, Uyghurs, and so on. And we're not going to stop. It's not like we don't say those kinds of things about countries if they don't threaten us economically. Whether we say them about countries depends actually not on the objective circumstances and their degree of guilt or anything. It depends on, right? I mean, it's not like Iran is actually a worse country than Saudi Arabia. Basically, whether we complain about somebody's human rights situation is a function of various things that seem to be having almost nothing to do with our relative power, right? I mean, we criticize powerful countries. We criticize countries.
Yes. But I mean, it has a question of like, so look, I mean, why do we criticize Iran is a complicated
actually
question.
It's not that complicated, but anyway, your point is we needn't get into it.
No. I mean, I do think we should get into it, right? But I mean, it's like, it is bad faith. It is perceived by the Iranians to be bad faith. But also the Iranians are not confused by it, right? They're not like, what's going on here? Now they choose not to like knuckle under to what it is we would want them to do in terms of Israel and the Gulf states, but like they know what's going on. And in principle, we could reach a diplomatic agreement with them. Under Obama, we almost did.
Well, wait, what do you think they think is going on? I think they actually, certainly an influential faction in Iran thinks we genuinely wish very bad things to happen to them and even maybe have imperial ambitions. And this is based on things going back to 1953, not just the human rights hectoring that I was talking about.
Sure. But I mean, it's not that we oppose the idea of economic development happening in Iran. We oppose Iran's geopolitical
stance. Yeah, okay.
In the region, right? Like that's there's a political alignment there, right? So I think that with China, you know, it's a different, what am I going to say? Because China has an aspiration to be a peer competitor to the United States, right? There is a rivalry on a different level that I think is not amenable to settling in the way that I think we ought to simply settle our scores with Iran and Cuba. And a couple, there's not really that many countries around the world that we have sort of big conflicts with, it seems to me. And with Iran and Cuba, like we have picked dumb fights that like we should just let go of. But with China, it is a more complex situation, I think, which includes the fact that because China is much more powerful than Iran or Cuba, they do things like they want to prevent American professional athletes from criticizing Chinese behavior in Hong Kong, right? We would not, if we were to have a diplomatic arrangement with Cuba, it just like, we would not concede to the Communist Party of Cuba that like Americans should not be able to say, I think communism is bad. Mm-hmm. I think Cubans wouldn't ask for it. Like it's fine. Like one of the reasons I am so in favor of reaching these agreements is that we would not have to give up anything that is meaningful. What the Chinese push on the world is quite extreme because they're a powerful country.
Yeah. But I would say, whether the NBA knuckles under to China as it has, and for example, arranges to have the Houston Rockets general manager fired, which I gather there are these rumors he's about to step down anyway.
Yeah.
Who knows what's going on there, but it'll sure be interesting if he steps down and then China resumes its normal relationship with the NBA. Anyway, I can see this is a big issue, and it's because China is a powerful country that it can throw its weight around like that and can exert influence on Hollywood. But it seems neither of these things is going to change if we have twice as many people and twice as much aggregate GDP as we have now. The fact is China's market is sufficiently big that Hollywood really wants to cater to it. And people in Hollywood are interested in maximizing profit. And that's the source of China's leverage.
Well, no, because like we can exert our own leverage.
Counter leverage on behalf of Hollywood or what? How would that work?
Like, we can say that, you know, if you want access to the American market, you can't be submitting all of your products to Chinese censorship.
Well, we could say that now, and I think it would be fairly effective. I take your point.
But the relative size of
the relative amount of leverage
makes an important difference, not just for, like, you know, U.S. cultural products, mm-hmm. but for all around the world. Like, right now we have a situation where if you had to choose, right, between access to the U.S. market or access to the Chinese market, in most cases, you would rather have access to the U.S. market. But not in all cases. Like, actually, so the one reason Hollywood has become an important flashpoint for this is that the Chinese domestic box office market has become larger than the American one for, I don't actually 100% know why, but movie ticket sales don't scale linearly with GDP. So, you know, the aggregates really count for a lot in these kinds of things, right? And who will sort of set the pace of the global rules of the road. And I think it matters a fair amount, and it involves genuinely hard to reconcile. I mean, there's aspects on the U.S.-China bilateral relationship where I think we could very reasonably give way to them on certain topics. There are issues like climate change where both sides sort of need to do more, but where, you know, we would be pressing them, at least for certain kinds of things. But I think that the sort of basic stuff around how capitalism is going to intersect with speech and human rights is really not something that we should accommodate.
Yeah, we should try to minimize the extent to which international economic engagement winds up constraining the speech of Americans.
Boom.
And this is you might be right that. I mean, of course, all of this assumes skillful policy on the part of America, which means what's the point of even talking about it? I mean, my view,
sure.
My view is that things could be much better with China than they are right now, and we could have at least as much influence on their human rights policies as we're having now, and things could be better on the climate change front and various other fronts if we actually were capable of exercising diplomacy and, you know, including forms of coercion, nonviolent coercion, skillfully on a consistent basis from administration to administration. But we seem completely incapable of that as a country. It isn't just Donald Trump. You know, we just can't muster the sheer consistency across administrations. Right.
Yes, there's a lot of problems.
Okay.
But I do think, like, I mean, there is a fundamental thing, which is, you know, I really believed in. I shouldn't attribute beliefs to myself in 1999 because I was too young. But, you know, around then, around the turn of the millennium, it seemed to me correct to say that economic engagement would give China opportunity to grow more. And then as they grew more, they would want to adopt modern information communications technologies. And that as they adopted modern information communication technologies, they would inevitably find it harder to maintain an authoritarian domestic politics. There's like Bill Clinton's argument very explicitly. But that seemed correct to me. And it's proven to be, backwards, right? That modern digital technology is actually a very powerful enhancement of authoritarian rule.
I wouldn't say it's backwards. I mean, I should admit, I speak as someone who made the argument myself, but
I think it's backwards. The market integration has allowed for exportation of Chinese constraints on speech to the Western world, to the point where you have, you know, like the CEO of Daimler apologizing for having the Dalai Lama quoted in some Mercedes ad copy, where Twitter is illegal in China, but what Daryl Morey tweets in English on a platform that's banned in China gets him in trouble at his job in the United States. And, you know, it's, I don't want to like walk back all of globalization because it would be somewhere between pointless, you know, and harmful. But there was a big mistake about that, in my opinion, and it needs to change the thinking of utopians such as ourselves.
Well, I mean, first of all, well, two things. I mean, the influences you cite on people like corporate CEOs and so on are unfortunate. I don't think that they amount to, in the scheme of things, a major suppression of speech. I mean, it's actually kind of a new thing, I think, that corporate CEOs and GMs of athletic teams, you know, express their political opinions to begin with. Corporations used to stay very, very quiet about all this shit. And the fact is that actors and people on Twitter and politicians and newspapers and you and me all say exactly what we feel like saying. And the conversation, again, I would like to minimize the result of this kind of unfortunate influence. It's bad. I just wouldn't overstate it. But the, my main point is, when you said we had it backwards, I thought you were going to say, actually, modern information technology makes it easier for the Chinese government to create a totalitarian environment. I don't think that's true. I think,
well, some people think that, other people don't. I'm not
well,
sure.
I think, look,
I'm
Chinese,
not sure I know.
It is harder to keep information about the world beyond China from Chinese people than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago by a long shot. It's not even close. And there is at least as much activism and even effective kind of activism, and not democracy, God knows, but in a sense, pluralism. That is to say, like, local people agitating about not liking a polluted pond in their area, about not liking something else, and actually getting redress from the government. There is more of that by long shot than there was in China 40 years ago. So I think the jury's out on what the long-term effects will be. I definitely underestimated the ability of the Chinese government to suppress speech domestically, even in this kind of technological environment. I definitely
Well, I also just think we didn't think through. I mean, you see this in market economies too, but just the extent to which digital technology is a kind of surveillance.
Yeah, totally.
Right. I mean, that was not something I mean, I sitting around doing takes and even in 2004, 2005, I wasn't thinking about, well, we're all going to have these phones in our pockets. It's going to show where we are all the time. You know, and like marketers take advantage of this, but it means it's not, the technology doesn't do exactly what we thought it would do. In addition to the fact that the censorship technology seems pretty effective, but it's like everyone's being tailed all the time.
Yeah, no, the scary thing is that leave aside an authoritarian government like China, in a free market system, the apparatus of surveillance, the panopticon, assembles itself through the magic of the market, and then it's just a question of whether you can keep control of it out of the hands you want to keep control of it out of, or, you know, or build in the insulation from it at the level of individual people through encryption and things, you know, various things. But
the craziest thing years ago, Google had some initiative internally that they called like Google News Labs. And it was supposed to be about how like Google can be useful to journalists. And they came by our office and they were showing us different things. And they showed us one thing that was like how they could track everybody's phones to like show how many people were going to different campaign events and different political protests and get much more accurate crowd counts. So I like had that in my notebook, and then like the next day I got back in touch with them, and I was like, that's really interesting. Like, can I write a story about this? And they like kicked it over to their PR people who thought about it for a day, and they were like, actually, no, we are not going to turn this into an API for journalists, because they realized how creepy it was. Like they didn't really want to even do this. Yeah. Right. It's as you say, it's like the technology just exists and it's like it's out there and you can monitor where everybody is all the time. And as it happens, they had no advertising reason to do it. But at first they were like, oh, this will be a cool pitch to journalists. And they were like, no, like nobody wants people saying like exactly how many people from which neighborhood went to which events. Like,
it's getting weirder and weirder.
It's alarming.
There's no doubt about it. So We shouldn't talk a lot longer. Let me just put an accent point on this. You know, my whole issue here with the a kind of a nationalist rationale for what, you know, a whole lot of this policy I'm fine with. But you have decided, I think, well, in part, I think, you know, you've decided that it's hard to sell all of these policies without getting people determined to make America great again or something. And I'm a little, you know, I'm a little more concerned about what happens with the nationalist spirit when it goes too far. I mean, I'll give you an example. It's like, okay, so your rationale for, to the extent that you would support year-round education, it would be more about harmonizing it with the work schedule of parents, maybe. But as you know, there are a lot of people who justify all kinds of educational initiatives because we have to compete with the Chinese. And sure. the logical extension of that is to just see our kids as these, like, warriors we're programming to compete economically. And I just think that's totally the wrong way to think about education. I think the purpose of our education system should be to create good citizens who are in some sense economically productive and are fulfilled and happy, period. And I'm sure you're aware that, like, kind of great power competition rhetoric can lead to different criteria for educational policy than those, and maybe you support those different criteria, but you see my point, right?
Yes. I mean, I do. I mean, I have wallowed long in the intellectual deserts of pure cosmopolitanism. And I have returned to what I think of as the lush greenery of the real world, in which we can try to think about these things, and a world in which, you know, people do care about, particularly in America, people care about patriotism and people care about the country and its symbols and what it stands for. And I think it is better and important to actually engage with that and try to see, like, what can we do with these sentiments that is more solidaristic, that involves in many ways more openness to the outside mm-hmm. world rather than Trump style closedness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how can we make it work to do useful, good things rather than sitting here and being, you know, well, what do you care about your declining community? Like mm-hmm. GDP has gone way up in Bangladesh. You know, it's a global community. And I think, you know, I was involved, you know, as a writer in, I think, some of that, moment of neoliberal hubris about the world and what really matters and all we should care about is malaria-treated bed nets in West Africa. And I think it has brought us to a kind of dangerous place because it is so detached from where people are, from how democracies function, and like what's going on in the world. So I agree with you about so much. I mean, I've gotten this. I agree with a lot of your domestic policy ideas, but what's up with this nationalism? Right. I agree with a lot of your foreign policy ideas, frankly. I want us to chill out a little bit. Right. But I want us to say that we are chilling out in a way that is consistent with caring about the United States and its role in the world.
No, I agree, in a sense. I mean, first of all, if I failed to say this, I should say that in your book, you actually advocate reducing defense spending, unlike many people who emphasize competition with China. And I applaud you for that. I mean, I would say I'm not a declinist in that. I mean, I'm not obsessed with relative economic decline, but I'm certainly not a declinist in the sense that I think we should try to make America a shining city on the hill, make our politics work again. I'm all for the infrastructure kind of program you're advocating and for most of the policies you advocate that would make America a much better place. I just have concerns about framing the rationale in a nationalistic context, although I'm willing to concede to make concessions to political reality to the extent that it's the only way to get stuff done. but with due concern about some of the side effects of great power competition rhetoric, I guess. I join you in wanting to make America a shining city on a hill.
That's good.
Let's
shine.
So I think, you know, I should say before I ask you my final question, which is what's your next book going to be? And I have a recommendation for that, by the way. But before I ask you that, I should say there's a lot of the book we haven't talked about. There is just the sheer argument that arguments against growth don't hold up. In other words, that we could, not only could we accommodate a lot more people, but it would have more good effects than you think, and so on. There's a lot of interesting kind of, I don't know, microeconomic stuff and social analysis and so on. So I should.
Enumeration. It's all in there.
Yeah. But now to the big question. So what's your next book on?
I don't know. I gotta ponder these things. I sort of want to know what happens in the election. I mean, it's not that I like have a Joe Biden wins
that's
book
interesting.
And a Donald Trump wins.
Okay.
Book.
So this is a hostage of fortune because I'm not sure if this will run right after the election, but go ahead and tell us, make your prediction.
I think that Joe Biden will win the election.
There's a disturbing disparity between Nate Silver's probability assessment here, which is right now at about 88%, and the betting markets, which is more like 61-2%.
Yes.
Do you have a theory about that? I mean, some people disparage betting markets. I actually think there's a lot of money now in those markets that is really focused on making money. And so it's no longer just, you know, a bunch of Trump sympathists. Do you have a theory about that disparity?
I think that it is true that – I think if you ask Nate about the polls, he will say that polling errors are possible – but that the errors are symmetrical. And I think there's actually pretty good reason to believe that that's not true. That, you know, it's unlikely that the polls are dramatically wrong, but if they are dramatically wrong, it will be in a way that favors Trump.
Right.
And it's because, people with low levels of social trust, are less likely to answer phone calls, very disproportionately likely to support Donald Trump. It's not that they're shy exactly. It's that, conspiratorial minded people just both like Donald Trump and don't like cooperating with survey takers. And so some pollsters have different methodological approaches to this. But the people who take that issue most seriously, they still show Trump is behind, but their margins are smaller. So I think it's correct to say that there's reason to be at least a little bit skeptical about the level of confidence that Silver has in a Biden win. Biden is up by enough. I just wrote an article on this today. Biden is up by enough that it's like the polls could be off by 6 and he could win anyway, in which case
people
will probably forget about all this. But it is way more likely that there's like a big error in Trump's favor than a big error in Biden's favor. And that's something, you know, even when they do the education weighting, right? That's been very focused on the white population because there was a big white working class movement toward Trump. There are a lot of indications of a move toward Trump among Black and Hispanic men. We do not typically see pollsters doing sophisticated weighting in the subgroups of the Latino population, even though it's known, obviously, that college graduates and working class people have different views, that Cuban Americans and Mexican Americans have different views. And when you look at how pollsters see the Latino subset, they're like, they're Pew and Quinnipiac, like they're all over the map on that. It probably doesn't matter. It's not enough people and too many of them live in Texas and California, but like there's questions out there. And so I think it is reasonable for financial sophisticates to, you know, think Trump is being a little underrated.
Okay. So anyway, as for what your next book should be, I don't even really care if you write a book about it, but I think it's time for a career shift. And you don't have to thank me for this, by the way, or even pay me. But I think you should start writing about foreign policy again. I think you should you should call this book your like magnum opus on all the issues that have been obsessing you. Transportation policy, housing policy, and on and on, and get back to writing about foreign policy.
All right. I'll think about it.
I don't think you're taking it as seriously, this recommendation as seriously as I admit it.
I think about it. Well, we got to see what happens.
Well, what if Biden wins?
Well, I mean, it's not just Biden wins, but it's like what happens in America? What happens in American foreign policy?
I don't think this has been a successful appeal. That's my sense. But
Check back in a year.
I mean, I would say it would be a good chance to redeem yourself with people on the far left.
Yeah.
Your foreign policy would be more to their liking than they would guess based on the things you've said that have made them say mean things to you.
That's true. But why do I care what they think?
Well, it would also be good for the world.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Well, that sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Well, this is fun.
Well, thank you. And good luck with the book and the next one.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Right. I should go.
Child care. Do child care.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. See ya.
Okay. Talk to you later.